From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour as we launch our 21st year on the air. I really appreciate everyone who has helped us get to that milestone. We are pleased and honored to be joined by Tom Brekka from the Thomas More Legal Society. Tom, good morning. Good day to you.
Good morning, Bob.
How are you doing today?
Well, we're doing just fine. Despite adversity sometimes in the courts, but that's why we're in business, I guess. It's a growth industry.
It is. I have a background as a sports writer, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard coaches talk about overcoming adversity.
Oh, God.
And,
I don't know that laws qualifies as a sport, but sometimes I wonder.
You wonder, don't you? I mean, it's one of the few occupations besides sports where you end up with winners and losers, as painful as that might be.
That's true.
Unfortunately, and well, I guess we'll talk about this first. A terrible ruling came down, and I don't like to bash the courts or juries or anything else, but I do disagree with this ruling in the case of David DeLeiden and Planned Parenthood. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. You were the lead counsel on that.
Well, I'm a little over the hill, Bob. I have some younger guys who maybe played a more active role, but I do pontificate, and I was in court for the duration and working with our team of lawyers. A great team, but the odds were stacked against us. We were in a hostile territory, and the judge limited the issues to reflect only on the laws that the defendants broke by their undercover journalistic tactics.
Mm-hmm.
What they found, how serious it was, and indeed they found some very serious things going on. That was all out of bounds, and the First Amendment was ruled no defense, so the deck was stacked against us, and the worse it was, well, the better prospects we have on appeal, and we'll be pursuing that appeal as soon as we're finished sorting out things in the trial court. So.
For those who may not have heard about this, this was a federal trial. Was it a civil trial?
Civil racketeering trial.
So a RICO charges?
RICO, indeed. Bunch of racketeers. I went through it, so I got into this. Back in 1986, I volunteered to help a fellow named Joseph Shidler.
I remember Joe well.
Chicago.
Yeah.
That he was sued under the antitrust laws, and then they added RICO, and that went on for 28 years. It ended just a few years ago. I don't think I'll be around for the end of this one, but I hope it has the same result. We lost in the trial court for Shidler. Scored a lot of points, we lost on appeal, but then ultimately made it to the U.S. Supreme Court three times. The last two times we were victorious very decisively. So I hope that's the result for David and the other defendants, and I just hope it doesn't last that long.
Tell us, because it's federal and it's a civil trial, it does not require a unanimous jury verdict. Is that correct?
Well, actually, it does. And we only had 12 jurors, no alternates, and two of those left during the trial. So we had, some good jurors, but they didn't hold out, and it was unanimous. Against us. They took them a week and a half, and I think those with reservations just had to give in because of the judge's instructions. They weren't allowed to consider First Amendment. They weren't allowed to consider the reasons the defendants went into undercover operations, nor what they discovered. And the deck was stacked.
Yep, so the... This was brought by Planned Parenthood, is that correct, the suit?
Yes, Planned Parenthood, Federation of America, National Planned Parenthood, and eight of their affiliates, most of them in California, but one in Texas, one in Colorado. Yes, we were up against the monster, with all its billion-dollar resubmit. Well, let's just say it's a very, very prosperous organization.
So if we, Tom, if we could leave out the issue of abortion here, which I always feel when you get into a legal arena, suddenly it's a different ballgame. There's special rules if abortion is the issue at hand. If this were, let's say David was going undercover to expose something in the meat industry, and we've actually seen that a few times, and had done the exact same things, posed as somebody he wasn't, and videotaped surreptitiously, and on and on and on, the exact same thing, except we're talking about the meat industry. Would the verdict have been the same?
Well, as a matter of fact, as you suggested, there have been undercover cases involving animal rights protesters, and within the last year, maybe a little more than that, the Ninth Circuit out in California, the appellate court actually overruled a verdict against animal rights protesters, and our judge still wouldn't budge and still held against us and kept saying that case didn't have any application. Well, we thought it had a lot of application. The fact that they use these tactics for a public policy objective to try and bring to light animal abuses, none of that, even though it applied four square in our case, none of that was allowed. Allowed to argue that. The jury wasn't allowed to consider it. So, as I say, the worse it is in the trial court, sometimes your better prospects on appeal are enhanced. And I think that's the case here.
So, to take the scenario even more dramatic, suppose this was an undercover operation to uncover human trafficking in the garment industry. Somebody goes undercover and exposes these people are locked in all day working 14 hours and not getting paid and are basically slaves. Same verdict?
Well,
the motivation of the undercover person has absolutely no relevance, according to the court or according to the jury, to the verdict. If you broke the law, broke the law.
I think that's a sparkling example of the trouble that this ruling is going to cause. The news media, social reformers, we have a long history of undercover investigations and social reform here in the United States, going back through our history.
Absolutely.
And ABC did an undercover operation on this very subject, baby body parts trafficking, back in 2000. That was shown to our jury. But the judge went out of his way to say, the law may well have been different in that case, telling that to the jury. So, this is a big setback for journalism generally. And, journalists have stayed away from us. Our clients, they initially came to our rescue, supporting us back in the beginning of these cases in 2015, filing a brief, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. But the other side got to them, and we haven't heard from them since. And I think they've hidden behind the propaganda put out by Planned Parenthood that these videos were doctored and deceptively edited. Well, guess what? They didn't challenge the accuracy of the videos in this case. No effort to undercut them or question their accuracy. So when push came to shove, the videos were true. And I think now maybe journalism the industry will take some note of it. I hope so.
Well, it's interesting, though, Tom, because the news reports about the verdict that I've read say that they were convicted and that they were guilty of manipulative editing. I saw those very words reading about this last night, manipulative editing. Not that the jury found that to be the case, but whoever was writing this news story about the verdict referred to it as manipulative editing. And I remember at the time when these came out, they said, hey, here's the whole thing. If you want to see the whole thing, it's a little bit, you know, it's 4 hours long or something.
Well, that's
but,
right.
But we did not manipulate anything. This person said what they said.
Well, you know, way back when there was an outfit called Fusion GPS,
right,
which has gained some notoriety in the Russia investigation involving the president. They're the folks who were asked to review the videos, and they came up with some claimed problems with them, and that was the put out in the media. Well, we hired another outfit, and indeed they found no doctoring, no manipulation whatsoever. And as I say, the proof in the pudding is that Planned Parenthood didn't raise the issue.
Mm-hmm.
We would have, and of course, the issue was held by the judge to be not part of the trial. So we weren't even allowed to argue to the jury, as we could and should have, that those claims of deception were false. As I say, I think we've got a pretty good appeal.
So why is this a RICO case? Explain what RICO is.
Well, I don't want to take as much time to go through all the details, but RICO is an effort to destroy the organization within organized crime.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of organized crime, you think of all those Capone and gangster movies, but of course you can't outlaw specific folks. You got to legislate generally, so they said any grouping or organization or collection or association of people that is managed through a process that involves a pattern of certain crimes that are typical of organized crime, that could be attacked, the organization could be attacked, and even if the people don't commit the crimes themselves, as managers of the organization, they can be held accountable for them. And over the years, they've added some predicate acts. They call them the pattern of wrongdoing. It used to be extortion, murder, things that organized criminals, gangsters do, but they've added, among other things, to get at terrorists, a use of at least six false identification documents distributed in interstate commerce. And that's where they got to Leiden, because he created the most amateurish looking driver's licenses with his high school picture on it, and anybody looking at it would see it was a fraud. And Planned Parenthood didn't really pay attention to it. They didn't ask him to hand it over to them. They just looked at it from a distance when he went into these meetings, and only some of the meetings, I might add, and that was held the predicate act here. And it's very flimsy. A lot of high school kids are now potentially subject to federal racketeering charges. It was aimed at terrorists, and of course it was drawn so broadly that here's David and his helpers caught in the dragnet.
So if to go the other way, if David was doing this to set up a stolen car racket or something, in a very strict technical sense, did he violate the law?
Well, we say no, and that's why, again, I think we have a good appeal. As in the animal rights case, where the undercover investigators were exonerated on appeal. He did this along with Sandra Merritt and other helpers for no money. This was not an attempt to get something valuable to take it over from somebody else. That's what the fraud laws are aimed at.
Mm-hmm.
He did this in furtherance of a public policy objective to try, and in fact, he went to law enforcement repeatedly, and that was shown to the jury, but the instructions didn't allow that to be considered any kind of defense. The fact is, he misrepresented who he was, and that's where the judge came down on him, and the fact that it was for a good reason, a protected reason under the First Amendment, frankly, in our view, that was barred from consideration.
Is there much case law other than some of the animal rights cases where the appeals courts or even the Supreme Court of the United States has held that if your purpose is good, you know, that's exculpatory?
Well, you know, there's a case that upset me very much when I heard about it, and probably upset your readers, or your listeners, I should say, and that was the Stolen Valor case, where a fellow misrepresented that he had won the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Right.
He was prosecuted, and, well, guess what? The U.S. Supreme Court exonerated him because this was a falsehood, it was held, but it was not for venal or materialistic purposes, not for gain. He was trying to make a point, a silly, self-centered point it was, but this was held, believe it or not, protected by the First Amendment. That's a pretty vigorous, robust interpretation and application of the First Amendment.
It is.
Which makes it all the more amazing that it was held inapplicable in David's case. Unlike the Stolen Valor, he wasn't doing that for his personal glorification or anything. He was doing this as a public service in furtherance of his fervent belief in the sanctity of human life. And his investigations, I must say, the record in this case, and there's also, you know, this criminal case, too, that we'll see what's going to happen in that case. But he did this to discover what I think are atrocities, not only the sale of baby body parts, but my gosh, some of these were harvested after babies were born alive. The record is closed, can't be distributed, at least the criminal record where this testimony was allowed. And I hope that'll be opened up and people are going to see through what David and Sandra and their helpers did, the extent to which the abortion liberty has been led to really, there's no better word than atrocity. And I think that is something that'll come to light and shock a lot of people who are already shocked by abortion. And many of them are not shocked by abortion, but they should be shocked by what is, in fact, murder, homicide. And, you know, we've got to wake up and see some of this that's going on in the shadows of the dark corners of the abortion industry.
Tom, you sort of anticipated my next question. Why was this a civil trial, not a criminal trial?
Well, there is a criminal case brought by the Attorney General of California, 15 felony charges, and soon we'll find out if that's going to go to jury trial, too. That's in state felony criminal court, also in San Francisco, unfortunately. You know, we'll get to that, I guess, soon enough. There have been other criminal charges brought in Houston, Texas. We defeated those 2 years ago.
Right.
And there was another civil case brought in Los Angeles. We defeated that one. The plaintiff backed off after saying they were going to appeal or win in the trial court. They decided to withdraw from the battlefield. We've also got another case up in Seattle where David is looking for details under the Freedom of Information Act, and the judge so far has brought down the curtain of concealment, saying that too much privacy is at stake, but that's on appeal. We hope the judge will, on appeal, will rule for us a second time, and again, a spotlight will be shown on the atrocities going on, I hope, in the name of research, but there's so much money. A lot of it is federal money funding this stuff, and the drug companies are involved, as well as the abortion industry. So those are some of the forces arrayed against against us and against the pro-life movement here.
So who's the Freedom of Information Act? Who is that request aimed at? Is it a public agency?
Well, we're aiming at the University of Washington, principally, which operates as a clearinghouse for, well, to put it literally, baby body parts.
So it's a state institution using both state and federal money.
Absolutely. Millions of dollars in federal money through the National Institute of Health. And, you know, it's protected under the guise of stem cell research, and yet the stem cell research has yielded little, if any, result when you're dealing with baby
stem cells,
baby body parts. The advances have stemmed from adult cells. And, you know, it's just an excuse, frankly, for the abortion industry and this baby body parts procurement industry that's also grown up to make a lot of money.
Let's be clear here.
Body parts.
Let's be clear here. You know, even though more advances obviously have been through adult stem cells, even if that were reversed, even if you did have more advances through through fetal stem cells, it's still wrong.
Well, the idea that you exploit the sacred process of begetting and bearing new life into the world just to, you know, that somebody's life should be sacrificed for the benefit of somebody else as a matter of simple,
can't be done.
Ordinary morals.
Yeah.
I think it's repugnant.
Yeah, can't be done. That's exactly right.
Part of our faith, and I think it's at the heart of the American ideal. Every person has inalienable rights. We don't say they're sacred in the government field, the secular world, but it's that fundamental religious truth that I think spurred those who wrote our Declaration of Independence and other foundational documents here. I do think that our pro-life values resonate wonderfully with our American values. That's my view. Difficult as it seems sometimes in light of the court rulings on abortion, but I hope ultimately we'll redeem those values.
So the jury award here was, what, $2.2 million?
Yes, but we're trying to unbundle it, and we think there's a lot of duplication in there. For example, they sued for breach of agreements where he signed exhibitor agreements and so forth, and at the same time, and it was awarded damages for that breach of contract, and at the same time, he was... I shouldn't say he was awarded. The plaintiffs were awarded damages also for fraud in inducing those agreements. So you can't have it both ways. There needs to be what we call an election of remedies. And, of course, punitive damages were awarded. Mm-hmm. And yet RICO has its own punitive component because the compensatory damages are tripled under RICO. So these duplications have to be scrapped. Whether the trial judge will agree with us remains to be seen. But
so, what happens if
we may have a good appeal?
If you're going to appeal this, what happens to the award? Is it just on hold? Is it collecting interest? Is it how does that work?
Well, we're in trouble on this score. None of these defendants is well-to-do. David is a mere 30-year-old young man who did all this when he was in his mid-20s. You generally have to put up the amount of the judgment or get a bonding company to agree to secure the judgment if it's affirmed on appeal. When the Shidlers were hit with their judgment, which was under RICO, trebled to 280-some thousand. I mean, that's peanuts compared to this.
Right.
And they had to put their home up as security.
Mm-hmm.
how we're going to bind this appeal is going to be a real challenge. We may not be able to, in which case they can move to collect it, and if they collect it and we win on appeal, they'd have to disgorge it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see sooner than later the answers to some of these questions. They're very, very tough questions. Getting a judgment against you for any amount is a bad thing, and when it's for $7 million, why, that's disastrous.
So what's your next step?
Well, unbundling the verdict, and it'll take the judge, I think, a while to do that. You've got to unpack these boxcar numbers, and like I say, you can't have contract and fraud damages at the same time. You can't have punitive damages for the state tort claims, we call them, fraud, misrepresentation, trespass, and also have triple damages under RICO. So I think it'll be reduced, but I think it'll still be end up as a $1 million judgment or close to it. If it isn't reduced, well, again, we'll raise that in our appellate brief. And so there's a huge amount of work ahead of us. And of course, that may also include defending a criminal felony trial. And if convicted on those charges, David and Sandra, his helper, could be in the penitentiary. San Quentin is one of them in California.
Right.
For 10 years or a bit more. So the prospects here are scary, and yet we want to be positive about our hopes and expectations. We need a lot of prayer. We need a lot of support, and this too shall pass, I hope quickly, but I think it may take a while.
So your first step is to appeal it to a court of appeals here in California?
Well, after we finish in the trial court, you know, we can ask the judge.
You still have to finish there.
There's not much hope he's going to throw out the verdict. It'll stand. He founded a Planned Parenthood clinic, to put it bluntly, in San Francisco. We asked to get him thrown off the case or to back off, and he wouldn't do it. Hmm. And the courts aren't ruling on that issue. So that's another matter that's up for appeal, I suppose. There's too many issues here to be appealed. We've got to kind of pick and choose the best ones and pursue them.
So everything's done at the trial court in terms of the verdict itself and the award, then you go to the appeals court. What's your strongest argument for the appeals court?
I think it's the First Amendment. I think we invoke that precedent that we talked about, the animal rights people,
mm-hmm.
and we say we stand in their shoes here, and what's the difference? Well, there was a statute that was passed by the Idaho legislature attacking their undercover investigations, but so that is a different fact, but the main point of the case, I think, holds true for our defendants, even though the statute here was one of general application, the trespass statute, the fraud statute, another one is unfair competition. They brought that too. That hasn't been ruled on yet.
Unfair competition.
Well, isn't that something? And, this is reminiscent of the antitrust claim in the Schneider case. We asked them, what market were they competing in? And ultimately, they had to admit it was the marketplace of ideas, not an economic market. And it's just ridiculous. So they just fired a series of shotgun blasts with multiple barrels in this weapon, and there's buckshot scattered all over the landscape here. So that's why I say a lot of cleanup has to be done in the trial court. But we'll be in the Ninth Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals, before it's over. And it'd be nice if it would end there, but I suspect whoever loses in the appellate court will go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and this will be a final judgment. And we've tried to get the case before them already, but that was before it was final. So I think ultimately the Supreme Court may well weigh in this case.
Well, it's interesting because the Ninth Circuit, you know, allegedly one of the most liberal circuits in the country, whether you like it or you don't, or no matter what your politics are, but it tends to be fairly good on First Amendment issues. I mean, I look at the Walter Hoy case, and it's the Ninth Circuit that ruled in favor of Walter.
Well, they did, and Katie Sharth, the lawyer who argued that case, is part of our defense team here. So, you know, if we strike the right note there, and if especially if we get some media folks to back us up, you know, we're not conceding a loss in the Ninth Circuit. We're aiming to win every time we go to court. And and, you know, the composition of the Ninth Circuit is moved a little bit rightward. If this is a right-wing cause, to me, it's as much a liberal cause.
I think so. I look at Walter Hoy's case, which was really a First Amendment cause, freedom of speech cause, and the court ruled, the Ninth Circuit ruled in favor of Walter, you know, and so you could say, well, that's a liberal interpretation, except the fact that he was protesting abortion, which makes him, quote unquote, a conservative.
Well, right.
You know, it's crazy.
It depends on your stripe or your appearance sometimes, but, you know, I shock a lot of people, and liberals take me to task for some of our advocacy, and point out that the justice on the left, who's famous these days, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we've had three decisions from her over the years, and two of them were 8-1 in our favor and 8-0 in our favor.
Right.
That's two out of three times.
Yeah. And I mean, so, I don't know what about being against abortion makes somebody conservative, you know? It's like,
not exactly.
I don't understand that at all. That's a basic human right.
Yeah, Justice Ginsburg, those were abortion cases. Those were the racketeering cases involving the Shriners, pro-life activists based in Chicago and carrying on nationwide. So, yes, we have, the First Amendment belongs to everybody, not just the left-wing activists or the right-wing activists. It's the lifeblood of the country, and I want to keep access to the press as wide open as can be.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you know, democracy can't function without information. That's a point made by my helper, Peter Breen, in his closing argument to the jury. Democracy needs information, and that's what these people were providing.
Absolutely, it's a compelling case. So, if it fails at the Ninth Circuit, is this the kind of case? People say, I'm going to go all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court doesn't take very many cases. Is this the kind of case where the Supreme Court is likely to accept it?
Well, I'm biased. I think it is, and the reason why we haven't gotten in there already is because they don't like to take cases before they're finished.
Right.
You know, we went up there a couple of years ago when this same Judge Orrick issued a, we call a prior restraint, you know, this gag order. There are videos that David took when he was at the National Abortion Federation conventions, those are under wraps. You know, ultimately, I hope that injunction is overruled, and those videos can be shown far and wide. I've seen them, and they're shocking. You know, if there's any more room for shock beyond what's already been shown, you know, drinking wine, eating salad, talking about crushing babies' bodies above and below the organs that you want to sell, horrible things, gruesome, and but you know, I think we've got a very good chance of getting this case before the Supreme Court. And frankly, if we win in the Ninth Circuit, the opposition may well get it before the Supreme Court.
Sure.
These are contested issues among the courts, and that's the kind of case that where the Supreme Court wants to get in and set uniform national law. So, and I suspect that the media are going to wake up, and I hope support our appeal when they realize that the tapes were true, they weren't doctored, they weren't deceptively edited, they weren't manipulated, notwithstanding stories to that effect. I hope we can make that case and convince people of the truth.
That's that's the difficult one, because every time I read about this case prior to the trial, even when the tapes had just been released, the most of what I read was, well, they've obviously been doctored, they've obviously been manipulated, just almost like a statement of fact,
that's right,
and without any attempt by the people writing the story to actually research it and find out that David said, hey, here, take the whole thing. Here's the whole thing. Look at it. And as you pointed out,
people in the media that are disposed against us on the underlying issues, and that explains part of it.
I think so. I think if this was about any subject other than abortion, it'd get a fair play,
right.
But because it was about abortion and was exposing all sides of it are bad, but exposing something really egregious, that that people just straight up put up that wall and said, this had to have been doctored. This couldn't have happened. I'm not going to allow anybody to believe that this actually happened.
Well, it's a form of denial.
Right.
People are in denial, and some people embrace the idea of the right to abort so ferociously that they're just not going to admit the truth.
Well, that's
a challenge we have equally to the legal challenge. I think it's up to folks. I hope the church will help in this regard. We were thrilled. The Archdiocese of San Francisco had a reporter in court most every day of the trial, and stories went out on the Archdiocesan website.
Right.
I'm hoping that they will send that to every Catholic diocese around the country. I think when people see what David discovered and see through this veil of concealment and secrecy, they'll be shocked. Abortion is bad enough that we're talking about infanticide here. And, the governor of Virginia blurted out some of these unseemly truths and impliedly earlier this year.
Right.
But now we've got video proof that indeed these things happen with regularity.
Yeah, and I saw the reaction to what the governor of Virginia said, and the denial again, as you say. And I said, well, okay, I'm a journalist. I'm open minded. I'm going to look at this tape, and he just said it. There's no way around it. He just said it.
No, he did. And yet, despite that, Virginia, they just turned blue, they said,
That's hard to believe. Yeah.
And the tolerance of abortion and even beyond abortion is all too common as well. So we've got a lot of self-examination to do, I think.
Tom, on the criminal trial, which, David grew up in my hometown right here in the Diocese of Sacramento, on the criminal side of this, I mean, it's really chilling. Money is money, and that's pretty. I can't imagine having an award against me like that. But on the criminal side, as you point out, going to the state penitentiary is no picnic. Are the issues the same here?
Well, the criminal trial is focused on eavesdropping. So it's much more focused, and frankly, I think we got much fairer treatment during the preliminary hearing in the criminal court than we did in the civil court. As you say, Bob, this is a matter of personal liberty at stake, and this is unfavorable, unsympathetic turf as well. We're up against the chief law enforcement officer in the state of California.
Right.
Xavier Becerra, and Becerra, I'm not sure how you say it exactly, but
Becerra, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, he's got his couple of his top guns in court against us. Our co-counsel, the former three-term prosecutor, Steve Cooley, in Los Angeles County, which I'm told has the largest prosecutorial office in the country, and Steve's primary helper as a prosecutor, Brent Ferreira. I've been in a few criminal cases too, so we've got a team of four of us, and if we've got to go to jury trial, we're ready, willing, and able to do it, and I hope we get a fair shake.
In the Superior Court of the in the county of San Francisco?
That's right, right on 850 Bryant Street.
Right.
Some people call it the House of Injustice. Not in this case. Our judge is Christopher Haidt. He's a former public defender, so he understands the rights of defendants, and so far I think he's done a pretty good job of protecting him. He's made some pretrial rulings that we disagree with, but, it's a horse race, and if we have to go to jury trial, we'll find out soon.
Does it have to be good evidence?
And we'll bring it before those jurors.
Does it have to be a jury trial?
It doesn't have to be. We could waive it, but I think we want a jury in this one.
I'm just thinking of the demographics of San Francisco.
Well, we're going to get, if we can afford it, jury consultants to help us get a good jury. We thought we had a good one in the civil case, so you have a point there. This is unsympathetic turf, and that may be true of the demographics generally. But, beyond a reasonable doubt is a high threshold of proof the prosecution has to meet.
And it has to be unanimous.
Well, it's got to be unanimous. So we've got some good defenses. These people were in restaurants where a lot of the taped conversations took place. David and Susan, she goes by Susan sometimes, or Sandra,
mm-hmm.
Merritt, they sought out public places where they recorded.
Right.
They didn't record in California and people in private offices. They went to restaurants. They went to the NAF conventions held in big hotel meeting halls.
Where there's not an expectation of privacy.
Well, exactly, and the definition in the statute is if you have a reasonable expectation that somebody not a party to the conversation may overhear it,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't say all of it, it says it, so any part of it is, we contend, it's not private, it's not protected by the law, and there were passers-by right and left in these convention meeting halls and in restaurants where there were busboys and waitstaff and
sure.
Nearby diners.
Sure.
And so I think we've got a good fighting chance, let's put it that way.
You can't go to a Chicago Bears game and expect privacy.
Well, Chicago Bears, they're doing so poorly nowadays that their fans are pretty quiet.
I knew you'd respond to that, Tom.
The 49ers, I guess, have what it takes this year.
Oh, my goodness.
Know.
Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere is right.
Yeah. Unreal.
Sometimes it's eternal. Sometimes it's scores.
Yes. Well, it's the city of St. Francis,
So indeed.
They always believe in miracles there. So we're talking with Tom Brackett. Tom, I haven't had a chance to, when we first scheduled this interview, it was because you had been honored by the Christian Legal Society at their national conference. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was indeed honored, and I'm, very humble in accepting the award that really reflects, frankly, the fact that I've been at this for probably too many years, since 1986. But, I've got a lot of great helpers, and they've helped us engage on these critical issues all around the country. I mean, the Schreiber case, it's started us out in this and took over my private business law practice, involved a charge of nationwide conspiracy. So I got to meet in defending that case people all over the country. And so my law partners, stuck with us for about 10 or 11 years, but then it just got too expensive, and I was not producing much in the way of legal fees. Schauder, you know, after 10 years, my goodness, you know, who can afford this kind of litigation? So we went out and founded this nonprofit, Thomas More Society, and we've been very fortunate in representing a lot of very wonderful, selfless people, many Catholics, other Christians, and I've been, it's been a thrilling and very enjoyable career for me, and I'm just turned 76, so I'm a little bit past the crest of the hill. I'm blessed to have many young, able helpers, and it's, as I said earlier, it's a growth industry. You know, more and more people are being challenged because of their faith, and they're willing to go against establishment values when they're contrary to the values we cherish, and we're very honored to be able to help them.
We should point out that even though we're talking about the Dalyden case and you mentioned the Scheidler case, that the vast majority of your work isn't really abortion, anti-abortion work or pro-life work. It's freedom of religion work.
Well, freedom of religion and, you know, family values. And when people stand up for the faith, sometimes they're attacked, and we're privileged and to be able to come to their aid and assistance. And
oftentimes it's really not so much freedom of religion, even though religion might be involved, as it is freedom of speech.
Well, that's true. It's especially true in the nativity field. We defend folks putting up nativity scenes, and sometimes people say, well, how can you do that? That's religion, and religion has to stay away from the public square. Well, no, it's free speech. If you can stand on your soapbox and spout your politics, well, guess what? They can't discriminate against you if you're preaching your religious faith. Values are values, whether they're political or religious, and if we don't advocate for them, they're going to die from disuse or neglect, and we don't want that to happen.
I was watching the swearing-in of in the impeachment case in the House of Representatives. I was watching a swearing-in, and the last words before the guy said, "I do," were, "So help you God."
Well, that's right,
yep.
And that's a prayer, and it shocks people when you point that out. You know, in Cook County, Illinois, cathedral of religious faith, all our courtrooms are emblazoned with that phrase, you know, on the wall. How do you describe it? It's not painted there. It's in letters that are somehow fixed to the wall. Mm-hmm. In God we trust. There it is.
Yep.
So even in our secular courts and our hearing rooms in Congress, we say prayers and...
it's even on our money every time I remember having a debate with an atheist one time who was trying to get that removed from the money, and I said, I'll solve this. Just anybody who's offended by it, just send the money to me, and I will dispose of it.
Wager, he didn't take you up on that.
No, he definitely did not. When looking back since 1986, 33 years, is there one case that stands out to you that particularly gratifying or particularly compelling or interesting to you?
Well, I suppose I have to say the Schauder case. You know, the maybe one of the happiest days of my life after marriage and so forth would be the day that we heard from the U.S. Supreme Court, certiorari granted, which means they agreed to hear the case.
Right.
You know, we were down in the dumps for so long in that case. We lost the first Supreme Court appeal where they broadened the RICO law. We had won in the lower courts on a narrow precedent, and they said, no, RICO covers non-economic activities, and from that point onward, for several years, we were, I call it a pilgrimage through the valley of the shadow of death. And that's where my partners gave up on the case. They thought, oh my gosh, what? He's got to quit this case. It's not, he's losing every battle. You know, no money is coming into the law firm. Well, it was a dreadful time, but, you know, one I was privileged to live through. And then we lost the trial, but we got a lot of public attention.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost on appeal to the appellate court. But that day in April, when was it? Now, 2002, we heard news from the Supreme Court. They took our case. And that was a very bright and happy moment. So they happen, and I hope we'll have one for Dave DeLeiden and Sandra Merritt and the folks in that more recent case.
How many people besides David and Sandra are actually parties to this?
Well, there's a famous California activist, Alvin Romberg.
He's from Sacramento.
Mm-hmm. And from Sacramento.
Right.
And Troy Newman, the head of Operation Rescue, the latest incarnation of that crusade. Let me see. I don't know. I'm probably forgetting somebody. And I, of course, the corporations that David set up.
Right.
I think that's it. And if I've forgotten somebody, it's only because I'm having a senior moment. You know, David is enough for me to handle, let me tell you that.
Yeah.
He's a very able fellow, and you know, he's in a heap of trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we pray for him. And
yeah, he needs prayer, and he needs support, and it's a tough challenge. And Sandra Merritt is a grandmother, and a beautiful daughter who just had some children, and she needs prayers too. All these folks do.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we'll pray for all of them. Pray for you, Tom, and for the great work you're doing, and greatly appreciate you taking so much time with us today, and we certainly appreciate all you've done in your life, in your career, and especially in these last 33 years. It's made a lot of difference to a lot of folks, and it's made a lot of difference to people that's never even heard of you folks, because you've really fought for their freedoms.
Well, thanks very much, Bob. I've been a pleasure being with you.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope. God bless.
You too. Take care.
Thank you. That's Tom Brekka, the head of the Thomas More Legal Society. And man, it's just so heartening to see sometimes in days that can sometimes see dark, to see people like that who are so clear on the issues, so reasonable, so understanding of the law, and trying to convince others of the rightness and the reasonableness of their position. And this is another such case. But so often, you know, they'll protect people's rights. You wanted to have a Bible club at your school, at a public school, and they say, well, no, can't have any religion here on the, you know, in the public grounds. And they go, well, yeah, but you have a this kind of a club and a that kind of a club, and you know, all these different clubs that they tend to have at junior high schools, middle schools, sometimes even elementary schools. And you can't say you can have those other clubs, but you can't have a Bible club or anything else, like a pro-life club or anything. If you have one, you've got to allow all, as long as they, you know, follow the rules for clubs and et cetera. You've got to treat them equally to all the other clubs. Those are the kinds of things that actually seem so easy, and yet you constantly you'll see school administrators say, no, your club, we were afraid it's controversial or some such thing, which is always a strange one when you're dealing with kids that are trying to learn how the system works, and to tell them that they're taking a position that's controversial and therefore they can't have that position is a little bit outlandish. Anyway, the Thomas More Society just does such great work, and Tom Brekka has been, really working hard in the Lord's Vineyard for a number of years. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.